right, welcome to episode 21. I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Today we are going to do one of those unorthodox interviews where I speak to an author instead of a musician. I grew up with this guy, his name's Bruce Mahart. He put out a book last year called The Wake of Forgiveness, and the very first show that my band Liars and Saints ever played was the after party for his reading for that book last year. His publisher just put out a new collection of his short stories, things that have been published before. It's called Men in the Making, Stories by Bruce Mahart. So today, we are offering a giveaway. I would like to hear, if we hear from three people, the first three people that can tell us why they deserve a copy of Men in the Making by Bruce Mahart, a collection of short stories, Bruce will inscribe and mail you this this book. So you're wondering how you do this. So what you do is you go to our Facebook page. How did I get here? On Facebook. And you like our page. And then you comment in the comments why, like in the thing, why you should have this book. And the first three people that give us the best answers, according to me and Bruce, will get a copy signed and sent to them. Excellent. So I went to a party last night, and it's pretty early in the morning, actually. But I did get a good night's sleep. I went to a party. I came back early. I didn't stay all night. My girlfriend, Jessie, and I, she actually set an alarm when we went. It's my new way of getting out of places. So Jessie set an alarm on her iPhone, and the alarm went off while we were at the party, and we had to leave to make it back so that I could finish up this podcast, put out episode 20. On the web, and then get ready for my interview with Kelly Willis at 9:30 this morning. So it's an early morning, and I decided to do laundry. I'm impressing you with my ability to do things before the sun comes up. Anyway, so my guest on episode 21, author Bruce Mahart. A quick little backstory. Bruce and I grew up together. We met when we were, 10 or 11, 12 maybe. And he's a year younger than me. We, his older brother was one, you know, has always been one of my very best friends. And we started our first band in junior high. Me, Chris Mahart, who's Bruce's brother, and Bruce. And Bruce played drums. He was terrible. Anyway, I moved from the Woodlands after ninth grade. I lived there from fourth to ninth grade. That's where we lived, the Woodlands. And subsequently, Bruce went on to become friends with my Uncle Chuck, who lived down the street, or who lives down the street from his parents, and his parents are very good friends with my aunt and uncle. We are family friends. My grandfather is Chris and Bruce's doctor, we've always had a very, very beautiful connection, and so I'm really proud of all of everything he's accomplished, and I'm really happy he was able to come over and spend the night in between readings. He's on a reading tour right now. I guess by the time this comes out, he'll be done. But you can find his book everywhere. It's called Men in the Making, Stories by Bruce Mahart. And you can go to the Facebook page, like our Facebook page, leave us a comment as to why you deserve a copy of Men in the Making, Stories by Bruce Mahart, and we will send it to you. Bruce will sign it. Shit, maybe I'll even sign it. I don't know. Here's my conversation with Bruce Mahart.
I see people, all kind of people, I see them every day. Wealthy people, downtrodden people, people still finding their way. Some take a shower, some take a bath, some don't ever come clean. Some live like criminals, some live like Boy Scouts, most of us live in between. Never quite as much as we think.
Bruce, 1 year I went Christmas shopping with Alejandro Escobedo, who's singing that last song. And it was a good 14 years ago or something. I lived in this gray house. And all we did was listen to Oasis and shop. And he just is a cool guy. He doesn't have to sing more than four notes ever in a song. His melodies don't have to have more than four notes.
Why is that?
I don't know. He doesn't have to.
He just doesn't
have to. He just doesn't have to.
Get away with it.
You can get away with it.
Just like you can live in a gray house, and that's how you give people directions. I'm in the gray house.
Yeah, just drive. Just drive till you see the gray house.
That's right.
My cousin Al has this thing. He has this house in Tiki Island, Galveston. He was like, hey, man, you want to come over to my house over there? I was like, how do you get there? He's like, well, you know how you get to Tiki Island? You take that main Tiki Island drive to the first stop sign. You take a right, and you look for the best goddamn house you've ever seen in your life. That's mine. I swear to God, that's what he said.
Did you get there?
I found it.
Yeah.
It was actually the ugliest goddamn house I'd ever seen. Like, without a doubt. It was, like, bright yellow with, like, God knows what over there.
So he was in full control of his irony. Mm-hmm. I like it. I like a guy like
without
that.
Without meaning to be.
Even better.
Bruce Mallhart, you've just released your second book, Men in the Making.
Yeah.
Where do I start with an author? You're the first author I've ever had on this show.
I don't know, man. What are we gonna talk about?
I don't know. What do you people talk
about? We talk about musicians.
Well, let's start here. Okay. I went to go see you the other day at the Texas Book Festival.
Yeah.
And you were reading with Donald Ray Pollock.
Yep.
Frank Bill and
Dan Woodrell.
Dan Woodrell.
Yeah, who said I think for the first time in his life, maybe in the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, he's doing nothing. He can do nothing but write. Because he's had some of the movies made. You know, Winter's Bone was
right.
A movie that was nominated for a bunch of awards, and that's based on one of his more recent books. So, yeah, he's kind of...
And you were saying he also has, like, 3 films in the making.
Yeah, I think so. I think pretty much... I think that's the way it goes, is that you get that first one, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're a proven commodity, so they start buying your screen rights for everything. Which,
sure.
You know, we'll just wait for that to happen. That'd be good. Then you can come sleep on my futon.
Yeah, I was trying to talk Bruce last night into writing a buddy cop... book being turned into a movie. All you need to have the line is that I'm getting too old for this shit.
It's like, so, do musicians do this? Because with writers, if you tell somebody you're a writer, everybody wants to give you a story. Do people try and give you songs all the time?
Oh, yeah.
That's the way
the guy with the best goddamn house, my cousin Al. I spent the night at his house one time in Dallas, and he liked to stay up really late, and we were up pretty late. It was like 4:30, maybe 5 in the morning. And we were sitting on his back porch, and he goes, you know, John Charles, I have a song idea for you. Okay, his accent is Cuban and Texan. You've met him. You know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
He has this accent. It's like this. Like, it's just very odd. So he goes, you know, I bet some of your characters in Wake of Forgiveness probably ended up having this accent later on.
They probably
like
did.
The Mexican Texas accent.
That's right.
You go down there, you're going to get hurt. So he goes, John Charles, I have a song idea for you. You take this title, Nothing Hurts Like Pain. Because if you really think about it, nothing really does.
That's true.
So you were on this panel with these other writers, and you guys were all talking. You were viewed as tough guys. These sort of like the new macho fiction writers, or what exactly was meant by that?
Well, I think, I mean, they titled the panel Tough Guys, and it seemed like we were all a bunch of softies.
Yeah.
But we write stories about kind of tough guys, kind of gritty guys, and I think that's where it came
right.
from. You know, I was talking in the conference or at that panel, like, when I told my mom I was doing this thing called Tough Guys, she's like, you wouldn't even stand in the snow cone line by yourself when you were a kid. You were
like, I was going to ask you to actually tell that.
Scared little boy all the time. And I was one of these kids who was just, you know, always hiding behind mom's, you know, the pleats of her skirt.
Right.
Just scared of it. And Donald Ray Pollock was talking about this too. He said, you know, he grew up in a really violent town with kind of a violent dad, and that's what made him pay attention to violence, because he was always kind of worried about it.
Yeah.
So you're always on edge, sort of waiting.
Yeah.
And I was a kid, like, you remember, you know, Johnny and I went to some of the same schools.
Yeah,
north of Houston, and when a fist fight would break out at Knox Elementary or Knox Junior High School, and everybody be circled around the fight, I'd be the kid, like, I would literally like go to the restroom and be sick. Like, it just makes me witnessing that kind of violence makes me physically ill.
Well, we grew up there with those. There were these guys called the Coster brothers.
Yeah, oh yeah,
Matthew and Darren. right? No.
Yeah, Matthew Koster and Darren Koster, and one of them was in prison by the time we left.
Yeah, they like raped people and stuff. They were really violent,
twisted people.
But did I ever tell you this? Because this is really, I mean, this is like, I mean, we might as well just talk about our lives because this is what informs everything we do.
That's right.
If I were ever going to write a very violent story, it would star Matthew. Matthew Koster would be in this. Yeah, I feel really bad if he's out there and he's hearing this or we're bad mouthing him. But he was a bad fucking kid.
Yeah,
and
I don't think he's a bond trader out there. You know.
Yeah, and I doubt he's like a podcast listening cat right now. Anyway, he wrote on the. Remember those big panoramic? They used to have big panoramic pictures in junior high and in middle school. My giant panoramic picture.
Everybody on the bleachers.
Yeah, he really wanted to sign mine. Even though he had kind of like bullied me and you know kept me on edge that year. It's 7th or 8th grade, but just the fact that a 13 or 14-year-old kid wrote this. What he wrote on the back of my thing, I'll never forget. Said, "Life is a shit sandwich. The more bread you have, the less shit you have to eat, Matthew." And I just, even then, I was like, who thinks like this at like 13 in the suburbs? Yeah. You know what I mean?
You know, I used to deliver, I had a paper route in the neighborhood, and his parents, for the Conroe Courier.
Yeah.
And his parents were subscribers to the paper.
That's right, you and your brother, every Wednesday.
Yeah. But to go collect for the paper at their house, like the scariest thing that I ever did as a kid. And nothing ever bad happened. It was just like I knew these two guys.
They were scary.
The big bullies were lived there, and I figured their dad had to, like you learn that behavior, right, from somewhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Violence makes its way into my stories. Like,
it does.
I think because of that, some of it is this notion that like you take something ugly and try and make something beautiful out of it, and that's what art tries to do.
Right.
This is great story that I always think of, a narrative poem by this poet, Bruce Weigel, who was a Vietnam poet. But he was, you know, he's one of these many kids who was sort of abused by a priest when he was young. And this priest would take him out behind these boxcars in this rail yard. And I can't remember which big city he lived in, big Midwestern city, I think. And he wrote this poem about it. And the last line of it's horrific. I mean, but he tells it in such beautiful poetic language. And the last line of the poem about him being, you know, sort of felt up by this priest on a regular basis and like filleting this guy. The last line of the poem is something like, I'm summarizing pretty badly, but it's like, if you say it clearly enough, it makes it beautiful, you know? And that's sort of, I've always sort of thought about that. Like, if you could take something ugly, take the grittier aspects of life, if you say them clearly enough, you know, you can make something beautiful. You can make something art. You know, you aspire to make art out of them.
Yeah.
So some of the stories that I've written have been reactions to, you know, to sort of violent episodes that I've either witnessed or been sort of struck by.
When you say witness, you saw it in the first story in your new book of short stories. Where you begin.
Yeah.
Story that involves a did you see that dog get hit? It involves a dog getting hit by a car.
Yeah, it was this time I had just gone to graduate school, and I think I was home for the summer or maybe for Christmas break, and I was engaged to the woman who would be my first wife, and I was going over to her apartment, and I was just like, I just wanted to be back at graduate school because it was like the most fun, and I was really learning how to write, and I was just thinking about books and stories all the time. And I was sort of wondering why, like, I'm going to see my lady. Why aren't I excited? And I was just sort of kind of bummed out about it. And it's sort of foul mood. And I was driving around the 610 loop to get over near her apartment. And all of a sudden, I just saw this, like, big dark shadow run onto the...
So you saw the shadow like you describe it in the story.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I saw this dog, this big, like, kind of Labrador dog just get barreled over by
the description
truck.
Of getting hit and kind of its skin rolling under itself as it slid down the it's pretty gruesome, especially to a dog lover.
Yeah, well, when something happens, it either happens and it seems like it went by in a second, or it seems like it's slow motion. But you know, fiction, you have to, because the reader, you assume that if you're doing your job right, when you're writing the most dramatic part of a story, the reader's going to start reading faster. Like, right. If you're doing it right, that's what you want.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
And so when the reader starts reading faster, you need to slow it down, like slow the scene down so it lasts. So you slow down and dramatize the most fast action parts of the story.
Right.
You speed up or gloss over the, you know, the dull parts.
Right.
You know, that's why you don't read a good novel, and when two people meet, there's not dialogue that says, "Hey, Right. Hey, how are you doing? Because that's just boring as shit, no matter what you do with it. So, but you got to slow down the drama. So you have to reimagine it, which is what's fun. You know, what's fun about it and rewarding. But yeah, these moments of violence have always, I mean, I've just had, I don't know why, I just see, have a tendency to be in places where, when I first moved to Boston, I've been living in this town for about 3 days, and I'm going to buy some chicken, I think, at this little delicatessen up the road. And it's like noon on a Thursday or something.
Right.
I'm sitting at the stoplight, and in the parking lot right next to me are these two guys just beating the crap out of each other. Like, their cars are pulled up. They'd had a, it was a road rage kind of thing.
Oh, really?
And I was just thinking, shit, Boston is a rough town, man.
That's what I think
of. It's like
of
the first thing I saw.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, you know? But I think Donald Ray Pollock is right. I don't think I see any more of it than other people do. I just see it really
acutely. It registers.
Yeah, I see it really acutely because I've always been so afraid of it.
Me too.
And I think writers and artists see things with a certain acuteness.
I think so too, because some people are like, oh, that always happens to you. Those kind of things always happen to you. And it's like, well, A, I registered them and I remember them. And I mean, probably sometimes we probably push ourselves subconsciously even into some areas that we wouldn't normally go into.
No, right.
For the material.
Yeah.
I mean, do you find yourself doing that? Do you find yourself in, you know?
Yeah, I think the best work comes from the subconscious, and I'm always, you know, I'm writing stories and I don't recognize the patterns as I'm writing them. I'm just imagining them, but you know, whatever your own fixations or hang-ups or fears or desires are, they're going to bubble up to the surface at some point.
Yeah.
I have a funny story. This bookseller yesterday in San Antonio said, okay, so now I've seen your novel and I've seen these short stories, and when somebody's having sex in these books, the girl's always on top. What's going on with this? What's wrong with you? And I said, I've never thought about that in my life.
Listen,
I've never thought about
Louis
that.
Louis C.K., you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The comic? He has a new show, which I've only seen a couple of episodes of, but he did an interview on Fresh Air, and I'm sorry to digress this, but he...
Was it as good as Gene Simmons?
But a reality show? It's not a reality show.
No, on Fresh Air, that horrendous.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's much better than Gene Simmons.
That was abhorrent.
He finds himself to be grotesque. So in the sex scenes on his show, he's always wearing a shirt. And also, he puts himself on the bottom in the sex on the TV show so that it doesn't look like he's victimizing the women he's having sex with. So maybe subconsciously.
Yeah, what's going on with that? But you know, I'd never thought. I mean, I wrote the scenes, clearly, but I never thought, hey, you're doing the same kind of, you know, I don't have to write that many sex scenes in the kinds of fiction I write. But I was thinking about it. I was like, she's right.
Yeah.
You know, what's that all about? What sort of, you know, interesting, you know, sublimated desire is going on in my fiction, and other people can see it before I can, and that's the kind of writer I am. I think most of the good stuff comes from my subconscious. I don't know what it's doing there, but it's doing something there, clearly. So
let's go back.
Yeah,
and let's say when, I mean, we've known each other for so long. I remember a time when I remember a time when you didn't say that you wanted to be a writer, but I remember a time when maybe we were. I was 16 or 17, and that's kind of, you were 15 or 16. You were getting into it then. Was that what? Obviously, you started reading at a young age. You were a smart kid. What was the first? What was the thing that where you said,
this is what I'm going to do?
Or maybe even not that. Like maybe you got an assignment to write a. Because I remember the first time I ever got a creative writing assignment in like third grade. It was like somebody gave me a whole chocolate cake made of ice cream. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I don't recall a sort of a kind of epiphany moment like that, because what I was always was a reader. Like, I just wanted to read, and my mom was putting these books into my hands. She was from Mississippi.
Yeah, you were talking about this the other day. Talk about it a little bit
more. She was from Mississippi, and I'm named after a town, this tiny little town where she learned to ride a bicycle called Bruce, Mississippi.
Right.
This little lumber mill, sawmill town. And so she was big on, you know, she read all the Faulkner books and Eudora Welty, and she was just handing me good Southern literature and other, you know, good books long before I really had much business reading it, I think. But so I was just a reader, and a really voracious reader, and probably a pretty well-practiced reader for someone my age.
Right.
And I did the requisite writing stuff. I mean, I can remember sitting, my grandfather had this old typewriter, made that wonderful sort of popping sound.
Right.
Something's missing now that we can't hear, you know, hear the words being made on the page in the yeah. same way with the scratch of a pencil or the pop of a typewriter. It's so quiet now.
Yeah.
But I loved that sound, and I would, you know, write these kind of horror stories because I'd read a bunch of Edgar Allan Poe stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, those are things when you're a kid, you're yeah. like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can, yeah. And emulation's important. So, I mean, I did a lot of that. But really, you know, I wrote for the newspaper in high school,
right.
but never still, I don't know. I don't think I
had. Did you ever want to be a journalist or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I started leaning that way, and I'm just sort of easy. I'm one of these guys where I've got this friend from southwestern corner of Minnesota, and he says, like, ho! Judas Priest, and right. he talks like this, and I can be around him for about 15 seconds, and I start, like, it's embarrassing because my voice just starts to emulate his.
Right.
And when I would go to the country as a kid, I would develop the twang immediately.
Yeah.
So I think I'm just, I don't know if I just try and please people, if that's part of my, but it doesn't. I think
maybe you have no personality of your own.
Right. They just start looking at you like, what are you, some puppet? You're like this creepy puppet following me around trying to sound like me. But I do, and I really can't, I'm aware of it, but I can't really turn it off. So I think whenever I've done something and found success doing it, like even a little bit of like high school level success, it got to be really alluring for me.
What was your beat in at the paper in high school?
I did news, like hard news, and then I was the editor-in-chief.
I did hard news.
I did the
looks
hard
like
high school news.
Looks like Salmon Row is going to be closed next week, and then right. Stop and Go is going under some that's renovations.
Right. They are out of the green slush puppies in the cafeteria.
Was it you and Paul Lauer that were working late when...
When Paul peed in the water
fountain? Paul peed in the water fountain?
Yeah, we were working on the newspaper. We had a deadline, and he was the managing editor, and I was the editor-in-chief, and they had locked the janitors had locked all of the bathrooms, and we were there late, and there was nowhere to pee, so.
But was it Paul was like the valedictorian, right? I had moved by then.
Yeah, he was salutatorian.
He was salutatorian.
And he got kicked out of National Honor Society because he peed in this water fountain, and he got sent
And then he cleaned it. That was the other thing. Well, Didn't he go and get some Comet and come back and clean it after he peed?
Yeah, I think so. But
I just had to pee.
This janitor lady saw him and was just appalled by it.
Isn't that weird? There's
and he ended up going to reassignment school for 2 weeks. Like he had to go to RA where all the, you know, violent kids were. It was very strange. Yeah.
That would be an interesting, I've never even really, I mean, I remember talking to him about it then. I wonder what his memory of it is now, just kind of the whole experience, including the RA. Like,
yeah.
I bet it was kind of...
The way he described it then was that everybody had to be really quiet. There was just this tough, militant kind of guy running the place.
You do this one thing, you literally have to do a bodily function. It's so weird, the trip that they laid, I mean, I don't know if they still do it in schools, but back then, I always thought that was so fucked up. Like, they're like, you know, hey, can I pee? No.
No, you may not.
That's such a weird thing to do to little people, like kids. It's almost
that's a lot of control. You know?
Yeah.
That's very strange.
Yeah. Well, let's get out of that world because this isn't. I'm not paying you $50 an hour.
No, so I really don't think. I mean, I really didn't have any real aspirations to be a writer, like a literary writer, until I got to college. I went to SMU for a couple of years and didn't have any money, and it was a horrible misfit there.
That was horrible for you, wasn't it?
I mean, I met a couple of really great friends, but otherwise,
right? Yeah. No. But I think like the experience of not having the money and going to a rich school is must have been fucking hard.
It
would have been like if I would have gone to Harvard, like not having the brains to be at the school or something. But you know what I mean? Like,
I just remember, you know, like when people were rushing fraternities, and I didn't even know what that was.
Yeah.
You know, and they were just sort of expected to do it because all their parents had, and they were legacies, and I just didn't even know what it entailed. So. You know, I sort of walked around with all the other kids to these frat houses and just sort of was just a wallflower the whole time. You know, it was not the best 2 years of my life. I met two really, really great guys there whom I'm not in touch with anymore, but I got out of there pretty fast.
Yeah.
So
I don't remember actually having conversations about it, but I remember your general vibe then was a little like... It just didn't seem like it was actually happening. Does that make sense?
And it was more of this fact that I'm just so influenced by my environment all the time. Like, so I get there, and then what I want to do with my life is like be a lawyer and make money so I can fit in with these people.
That.
And so I was poli sci and public relations, and I was thinking about going to law school. And when I finally
were
left.
Were you really thinking about going to law school?
Yeah,
did you think about it when you were alone?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. That's
what kind of lawyer were you going to be?
I don't know. Some really good, despicable lawyer, probably. and so I went back, and I'd been working for, you know, for your Uncle Chuck.
Yeah.
From the time I was 16 at this conveyor belting distributor, Industrial Rubber Products, in Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
And I learned all this. You know, I just learned all about the business.
You did learn a lot about it. I mean, there's
still know
like
a lot
things
about
that
it.
Come out in your stories and stuff that are just like, you know.
Yeah, there's probably, you know. I don't know. It's not much of a claim to fame, but there's probably only a couple hundred people in the world who know as much about conveyor belting as I do.
That's what you were. I heard that on your All Things Considered interview last year.
That's all he wanted to talk about.
Well, it's just weird that some guy. I mean, you met characters there, and I mean, those were people that influenced your life and stuff. Like at that point, where were you at with writing when you went when you came back from SMU?
Yeah, I mean, I was still. I found out when I got to University of Houston, because I was still thinking, I want to go to law school, make some money. I was a blue-collar kid. I think a lot of blue-collar kids want, like, man, I just want to, I don't want to worry about money. Yeah, I've watched my parents worrying about money the whole life. This is sort of not atypical, kind of knee-jerk reaction, but I got to University of Houston, and I was, somebody told me, you know, they have got, they have a pre-professional English degree, because I was like, man, I got to take these classes, and I just hate taking these poli-sci classes, and all I want to do is read good books. And they said, you could be an English major. They've got a pre-professional English program that's sort of designed for you to go into graduate school for professional school after that. And I said, no shit. And I went and looked it up, and it was true. And so I started taking all these English classes, and I was really, like, happy in school for the first time, just reading all these great plays and poems and stories. And when I was a 23-year-old sophomore. So it took me 8 years to get through. I was working, selling conveyor belting all day long and then going to night school. I took this class called, it was just an introduction to the short story. And I'd never read many short stories. Read a lot of novels and a lot of poems and plays. But there were just all these great stories, like one after another. It was just, every night I'd go home and I'd read the story for the next day and it would just peel my scalp back. And then I read this Eudora Welty story called Powerhouse, about this jazz blues pianist, and he's described in sort of animalistic terms, and he's just this wild, huge, hulking black man who just charisma, just astounding charisma, and they're playing this bullshit, his band is playing this terrible white people's dance in Alligator, Mississippi, and they play the set, and they finish, and they take a break, and they go across literally across the tracks to this juke joint, and Powerhouse says all these cool things like, where are you going to find enough beer to put on this table? And he, like, pulls change out of his pockets and lets the coins roll through between his fingers and says, here's a million nickels. Let me hear Bessie Smith play on the jukebox. And the story, like, nothing happens. Like, almost nothing happens in this story. They're playing a gig. They go have some beers and chit-chat with the locals. Mm-hmm. They come back and start playing the second set. Like, not much action, not what you would normally expect from a story. Right. And it just, like, it blows you away. It's just freaking unbelievable. And I read it, and I read it again, and I read it again, and I read it again. And I was like, this should not work. Why does this story keep working? Like, this story is moving me. Like, in some serious way, like, every time I finish it, I got to go outside and, have a cigarette and drink a beer. Like, it's just really ramping me up.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided, I'm not only interested in what stories mean, I'm interested in how they mean it, like, how they make meaning. And
explain,
I figured
that out a little bit.
Well, like, that story, for instance, doesn't have the normal, like, there's character and there's a sense of place, but there's not the sort of traditional rising action and climax, and then you get a realization of the character at the end. It's doing all of its work by kind of modeling the improvisation of jazz music that's being made on the stage. Like, they do everything by signals. There's all this mystery, and, like, he just looks at the bassist, and the bassist starts riffing this certain way.
Right.
And so it turns out, I think she had just gone to see, I think it was Fats Waller. Eudora Welty had just seen him the night before, and she just couldn't. And so she's writing a story that sort of emulates that improvisational nature of jazz.
Right.
The way it's different every time. It always gets made fresh on stage.
Yeah.
And so to show that, not only is she showing them playing music, but she's showing they've got this story this sort of myth that they've developed about Uranus Knockwood, who's the backdoor man, you know, and he's sneaking around with his lady, and he's, Powerhouse is telling this story about his lady jumping out of the window and her guts are splattered all over the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And the story by itself doesn't make any sense, except it's this old sort of archetypal, you know, backdoor man story, or you know, I think, what is it, Sancho, like the Mexican tradition? Sancho is the backdoor.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is, he just fabricates this name, Uranus Knockwood, which has all these
backdoor, you
know, backdoor implications and violent implications and knock on wood for luck. I mean, it's all these things sort of working together. And I realized if I'm going to learn, like, I couldn't articulate any of that at the time. I had to go to, I said, I got to take a class on writing stories so that I can know how this meaning gets made in such a non-traditional way, in an unconventional way.
It was almost like she was writing in jazz.
It is. I mean, and it's like, and that's what makes it so
like
powerful.
It was a language or something.
Yeah, I mean, and I haven't seen that much of it, but you know, I've lucky enough to have gone to the Village Vanguard a couple of times and seen, like, you know, I haven't been to much live that kind of improvisational jazz, but when you see it, it's different than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah,
And you see any band that's really tight.
You can see five different guys play the same song, but it's a different.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a different vibe each time.
Yeah, and they said that about. I mean, if you were to go see, you know, if you were going to go see Coltrane back in those days and watch him play, every time he'd play, you know, they'd play three shows a day. It would always be different.
Yeah,
it'd always be different.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what she was kind of doing. And so you learn that there are ways to make meaning in stories other than just plotting, like what happens.
Right.
And so, you know, she said, Welty said that place was the lesser angel of fiction.
Right. And you guys were talking about this the other day.
Yeah. I think she meant that character is the archangel then.
Right.
And so that's how you do it. Like you make the stories through the characters, not the events. Good fiction's not about what happens.
Right.
That's like the stuff you buy in the grocery store. Those books are all about what happens.
Right.
But literary stories, like good artistic music, like good art, it's all about human beings.
Yeah.
So, you know, the story's about the who that the what happens to.
Right.
Not the what happening.
Right.
You know, so... and then once I started writing it, you know, trying to do it myself, I was just sort of hooked. Because it's like dreaming while you're awake. I don't know if songwriting's like that or not.
Yeah, that's the same as storytelling.
You just sort of completely fall into the story and you forget, you know. On a good day, which doesn't happen very often, but on a good day you sit down and you start working and you think it's been about 15 minutes and you look up and you've been sort of dreaming this story for 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, you just sort of lose the temporal world, which is just, it's magic, man. It's magic.
Yeah, it is. It is magic. So, it's creation.
Yeah.
You're making something where there once was nothing.
Yeah. It's just, you know.
So you said that you took a class after you read that story.
Yeah, I took a class. I think I took a class. You had to take a class that was poems and fiction. And I remember writing this bad story set in like Santiago, like something really mysterious. And I'd never been there.
Right, right, right.
But it went okay, and the teacher was encouraging enough that I took the next class, which was just fiction writing, and it was with a guy named James Robison, and he had a book. He went to Brown, and he had a book of stories out that did really well, and then a novel that was sort of experimental, and he's still out there. I got an email from him. I put him in the acknowledgments page of the first book, and he's this real reclusive guy. I just remember he was, you know, he was a painter. His father was like a coffin builder somewhere in Ohio.
Wow.
He wrote these really beautiful, funny, but moving stories in his book called Rumors and Other Stories. But he was just this, he was reclusive and like weird and he would just disappear. And he was, you know, he's also like jogged 5 miles a day.
Was he like a manic depressive guy or something like that?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to get to know him well enough to make much of any assumptions about who he was, but he was a great teacher and he taught craft, like how to make stories and, instead of, you know, trying to teach you how to imagine a story. I don't think you could teach somebody how to imagine, you know, that's the sort of, that's the concept, the conceptual part of things. All you could teach is the mechanical, the craft part.
Those things come to people with the imaginations and then somebody has to be able to, but you can't teach
You can't teach the imagination. I mean, it's like,
I don't think you can teach someone how to be creative. You just are, you aren't.
Right.
To me. And
people have it in different ways. I mean, whatever people talk about in terms of talent, whatever that means,
right.
I'm still not sure what the heck that means.
Right.
But I think what they mean is that person has a propensity for this kind of imagination.
Right.
And so story writers, novelists, we see the world in stories. And
right.
musicians hear music. And,
right.
You know, math people like, have numbers going on in their heads all the time, right? I've got a, you know, awesome kid who will be my stepson about a year from now.
I've got some math friends.
I do have some math friends.
No, but go ahead.
I got this real mathematically minded future stepson. When I get married about a year from now, he'll be my stepson. He's already my kid. But when he drives down a street, he can tell you like how many steps lead up to the front porch of every house. Like, he's always counting steps. And he says he counts steps when he's walking, and he's particularly paying attention to multiples of prime numbers. And he's not a savant or anything. He's just, that's...
And it's not OCD or anything,
yeah,
right?
That's just what's going on in his head. You know?
Right.
I have this friend Marvin from my first real teaching job in Houston, and he's a bibliographer, but if you say a sentence, just any sentence... he can tell you immediately how many letters are in the words of that sentence. That's kind of the chew toy that his brain is doing all the time.
God, that's weird.
It is strange. So people have these different creative, imaginative impulses. Yeah.
Eventually they go mad.
Well, he's mad, yeah. He doesn't have any teeth because he falls down a lot. He drinks a lot. And...
Whoa.
But he could tell you how many letters are in a sentence, which is really cool.
That is really
cool. Not a big market for it, really.
Yeah. So how much time you were in Houston for like 4 or 5 years?
When
you came back from SMU?
No, I was there for 7 years.
7 years.
6.5 years. And I was working, meeting all these interesting guys. Eventually in this conveyor belting company, I started going out and doing some sales work and doing some installations. And so I would go to... you know, food manufacturer, the Mrs. Baird's Bakery.
Right.
And the Owens Corning shingle plant.
Right.
And just all of these ready mix plants and asphalt plants and mines and lumber yards and refineries. So I just was around all
you
of these.
You filled orders for conveyor belt and you went out and sold them.
Yeah.
And you went and.
Yeah, that somebody call and say, my conveyor belt's broken. And so you get in the truck and go out there and see what kind of conveyor belt it was and then give them a price and then. Call in the order and go pick it up and take it back to them. Because there's a lot of kinds of conveyor belting.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And sometimes install them for them, that kind of stuff.
So what was going on with you while you were doing that? You're picking up on people listening?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's
what you do. Yeah.
And I got really, you know, what shows up notably in this book of stories, many of which I wrote so long ago, like when I was in graduate school, is all the industry, like all the heavy industry in the book. There's chemical plants and guys who work in refineries and guys who work offshore. And,
right. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but at one point I remember in our late teens or early 20s, you were going to go work on an offshore oil rig.
Yeah,
I did.
You did? Yeah.
I went for
two hitches, and then I basically staged an accident to get off of there, which I don't think I've ever told anybody. But it was so awful, Johnny.
Okay, I remember this now.
It was the worst thing in the world.
I thought you were going to be gone for a long time, and then it was like, hey, Bruce is leaving for like however long you go out there for, and then like 3 days later, you're like, hey, you want to grab a beer? You were back.
Well, I did a complete hitch.
What is
as
that?
They call it.
I don't need...
2 weeks.
Okay.
So you go for 14 days, you work 12-hour days every day, and then in the middle, when the previous group goes home, they switch you. Like, you work mornings 12 hours.
Right.
And then in the middle, you work a 24-hour shift. They call it getting shortchanged, which I always liked.
Yeah.
You get shortchanged in the middle. So you work a 24-hour shift, and then you work 6 more days of 12-hour shifts, and then you go home. And it was terrible.
That is fucked.
It was really terrible. And the guys are really nice, and they're all, you know, you're sort of all literally in the same boat, except it's not a boat. It's this jack-up rig. But they were, like, putting us down in these void tanks, spraying urethane sealant around, no respirators, like, dark and damp and chemicals everywhere. And I was just miserable.
Sure.
And then... I was a painter's hand.
Let me ask you really quickly. Let me go back. What was the impetus? Where did you, were you going? Because I can't remember. Were you going like in this Hemingway kind of like, I'm going to go do this tough guy thing.
No, I don't think it had anything to do with it.
It pays real well.
That's what it was. Okay. It was like for a job that you could get, I think it was 20. 19 or 20.
Yeah.
So I was still in school and it was summer and I'd always been working for the conveyor belting company. I was like, they weren't paying me great.
And this was kind of 2 weeks on and some time off.
Two weeks off.
Have more time off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had this, this girlfriend, dear friend for years.
What's your girlfriend then?
Who was a ballerina.
Oh, yeah.
She was a former girlfriend at the time. She was off dancing already as a professional ballerina, but her dad owned this oil exploration company.
That's right.
Lebanese Texan Aggie Fred Nasser, who was just
Melanie Nasser.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. And he was just the sweetest guy. And he said, hey, if you ever want, you ever want to work offshore, make some good money.
Yeah.
And it was good money.
And you got along with him. I remember going over there with you then.
Oh, I adored that guy.
You guys were good buddies.
I love that guy.
Sorry, go ahead.
So he took it. Yeah, he got me this job, and I went offshore, and you just didn't realize. I thought I was going to be like wearing gloves and walking around on deck, and the crane operator would lower some pipe.
No, they stuck you in a hole with like caustic, and toxic materials.
With this, just this completely disgusting, chemical swirl everywhere.
All right, so you're back on the rig.
Yeah.
And you're there, what accident did you stage?
I was there 2 weeks and I came back, and then 2 weeks later I came and it was like 5 days into my second 14 days, and I was just sick. Like, I just was sick of being out there and lonely, like, couldn't believe.
Yeah.
And so they had me painting the second time I was painting all of the handrails all the way up to the helipad of this rig.
Right.
All these safety yellow handrails. And I sort of staged falling down in just the right way so that I wear glasses. So my glasses would fall off my face and into the water below. And then
sacrificed a pair of glasses. I can't see. I can't be on this boat anymore.
And then I went to the tool pusher and said, man, I really screwed up, man. I fell down and my glasses fell off the rig. And so they sent me back to shore to get new glasses because I was too, I was just too afraid and embarrassed to say, I hate this. I want to go home.
Of course. Yeah, I'm scared.
I want my mom.
Yeah.
So I staged this stupid accident and forfeited, a $200 pair of glasses or whatever. And they sent me home to shore to get new glasses. And then I was supposed to come back and I just never came.
How did you handle that? Did you call Fred Nasser?
No, because it wasn't his company. I think I just called the tool pusher at some point.
They probably were like, we didn't think.
Nobody ever loses their glasses over the side of an oil rig. I mean, they probably knew immediately. We've seen guys do some stupid shit to get off of this rig, but that is among the most ridiculous. All they had to do was say, I want to go home.
So when was it that you got accepted? Were you sending off to graduate schools to get into writing programs?
Yeah, I did. I read a story in one of the early fiction writing classes that this guy James Robison was teaching. And we had to write a short, like a story in under 500 words. And I wrote this little story. And we all read them aloud. And after that class, which was pretty early on, he pulled me aside. He said, hey, man, you should really think about going to an MFA program. And I said, what is that? I have no idea. Like, I didn't know you'd go to graduate school for
writing
in the arts.
Right, yeah.
I thought you just went to France and like drank wine and wore a beret. And,
smoked cigarettes.
Yeah, smoked cigarettes. And then you were a writer. And he told me what they were. And I started applying to graduate schools when I was close to finishing up with my undergrad after all those 2 years. And then I got to be a full-time student, like for the first time in years and years. I chose the Ohio State University because it was the most time. They gave you full funding and let you teach a class and paid you a stipend, and it was free. They waived all of your tuition and fees and all of that. So I got to go be, for 3 years, I was just reading and writing and teaching, you know, in many ways, the best 3 years of my life. Just to be so focused.
Yeah, I remember on talking to you and getting those stories then and just being, you know, there was like a real fire.
Yeah, well, and you're surrounded by all these people who want to do the same thing. Like, and so we talked about nothing else.
That's all you did.
You know, we just talked about making stories all the time.
Yeah.
And reading, you know, I used to read in graduate school. Other than the stuff I was reading to write papers, I would always read at least a collection of stories and a novel every week,
right.
You know, in addition to what I was reading for the classwork that I had to do. So just absorbing all of this great literature.
You know, you're finally among other people that's all they're thinking about. So that's all, you know, you got to think about.
Yeah. And, you know, three or four.
And that's what makes you good, you know.
Three or four of my dearest friends are, you know, guys that I met there. And it's just because, yeah, we shared this really intense experience of like...
Is that where Lee K. Abbott is from?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So he was one of your teachers there.
He was the director of the program and kind of became my mentor. Him and this woman who's no longer there, she's at University of Utah, named Melanie Ray Tone, who's just a fantastic short story writer and novelist. Her books keep getting kind of more and more cerebral. More and more difficult,
right?
So she doesn't have nearly the audience she deserves. But in the in the 90s, she was in Best American Short Stories like every other year.
Oh, really?
She's just fantastic, and she's this meek woman. And she's really soft spoken, and she's really affectionate. But like, if you go out to dinner with her, she'll say, if you're in an Italian restaurant, she'll say, "Can you bring me some pasta boiled with no oil or butter on it, and then some vegetables that are steamed with no oil or butter on it." And she's just, I don't know what her deal is, but she's just this very, like, very health conscious, really smart, wildly read, and just wonderfully empathetic. Like, she writes these gritty, gritty stories.
Really?
And she's just meek and sweet and generous and warm. So she was a big influence as well.
And so what does a mentor in writing, I mean, they read your stuff, they give you pointers,
I mean, all of your teachers do that.
Like, this works better if you make, like, condense this or elongate this.
Yeah, or move things around, or like, stories are, I don't know. I tell my students, when you write a story, like, the story makes a promise to the reader, and you just have to fulfill the promises. So, I mean, like, Chekhov talks about, you know, if the curtains pull back on this act one of a play and there's a shotgun hanging over the fire, like hanging over the mantle, then the play can't be over until that shotgun goes off, right?
Right.
So, like, if something is there, you're making a promise to the reader. You got to fulfill the promise. And it works the other way, too. Like, if a shotgun goes off at the end of the play, you have to put it over the mantle in scene one. Like, it can't just come out. Like, fiction's not as easy as life. Like, there has to be order to it. You can't have coincidence and happenstance sort of solving the predicaments of the stories. That's sort of the old Greek way, the deus ex machina, you know, the god and the machine will create this story, and it's so convoluted and goes on for days, and at the end you just got to lower an actor down dressed as a god and have the god just make everything better.
Right.
You know? And you can't do that anymore. So, you know, the stories have to be resolved by the characters, by the volition. And that takes, you know, that takes some understanding of not only paying real good attention to your characters and being patient so that you make sure you're not forcing them to do something just because you want the story to end a certain way.
Right.
But it's a kind of empathetic journey that you go on with the characters.
And
it's like, there's a cool writer, Ron Carlson, who writes these beautiful stories that actually have happy endings, and they're wonderful. But he says, when you're writing a story, you're just driving a bus, and there's guys on the side of the road, and when you see a guy, you know, you pull over and pick him up, let him on the bus for a while.
If someone wants to get off, you drop him off.
Yeah, if he's not working out, or if he's, like, you know, pissing on the floor of your bus or something, you just pull over and let him off. But you know, characters do just appear.
Yeah.
There are these twins in the novel, my first book, these kind of twisted twins.
Yeah.
And they just showed up. Like, I was writing this scene, and I kind of thought I knew what was going to happen in the scene, and all of a sudden there are these twins there. And I didn't even know who they were. And then I realized, hey, at the very beginning of this book, I talk about this midwife who's just delivered these twins. And then I knew who they were, but nothing about them.
Right.
So they just sort of announce themselves.
Right.
And that's what I mean by the subconscious doing most of this good work.
Right.
I don't know where it comes from, but it comes
from
me.
It's like songs. It's like when I actually was talking about this yesterday. It is subconscious. Sometimes I'll write songs, and so lack of a better word, to get in a zone where you're just kind of just writing, and you step back and you look at what you wrote, and it really is how you feel about something that you haven't admitted to yourself even yet. But you make these discoveries. I mean, you know, but obviously your writing is so much more vast. There's other characters. It's not just you and your point of view.
Right.
For, you know, three verses, you know what I mean? And a chorus that repeats or something, you know?
Well, you have a lot of outlets, I think, but you know, every character is you and every character is not you. And
right.
The most important thing for, like, if you really care about making fiction that is trying to mean something, even if you don't know what you intend it to mean, but you're aspiring to make art rather than just entertainment, you know, you just have to be patient and wary of the temptation to, like, take them. I always think of Plato, those Plato, what was that thing called? Where you put the Plato in the thing.
Oh, yeah, it's almost like a meat
lever.
Grinder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I always think about that. And, like, if you take your characters and just extrude them like Plato through, I want to make a star-shaped story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to make a square story.
Yeah.
Then you're going to end up with, you're going to end up with a story that might, I mean, people might be interested in it, but they're not going to learn anything about human beings.
Right.
And that's the difference between literature and just entertainment fiction. So you learn something from all the characters, and there's some of you in all of them, but there's also some of everybody else you've met in all of them. You know, I've never modeled a character on a single human being in my life, and I don't know why I would.
No.
I'll just go talk to that person.
Yeah.
If I want to hang out with them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So
you didn't, you stayed in the program. You didn't get published until you left, right?
I had one story that was accepted my second year of graduate school and published. My first published story came out my final year of graduate school. And then I started selling stories pretty fast after that.
Okay.
And some of that's just the business. Like, it, you know, if one editor has said yes, the other editors give you a better read.
I mean,
it's just, that's just the name. They're getting so many stories from so many people. So I don't think I necessarily got that much better that fast, although I did get a lot better at Ohio State.
You just got published a lot.
Yeah, but I got published a lot more, because once it starts, it's just like a snowball.
And these were all short stories that are what appears in this book.
Yeah, many of them are here. And
You didn't sit down and write any of them specifically for this book after you wrote your last book.
No,
Yeah,
what I did was, I mean, I changed some of the stories and revised some.
Oh, yeah?
But mostly it was a selection of, like, what to keep in and what to leave out of the collection.
Like one last edit or something?
Yeah, and no, but like whole stories.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So some of the stories just don't fit with this. Like, these are all kind of gritty Texas stories about men and struggles with understanding masculinity. So they range all the way from, like, initiation stories, coming of age stories about boys, to, like, some really messed up men. And then hopefully...
Now, all of that is covered in your novel in, like, a...
Yeah, in different ways.
Yeah, in different ways, but, you know, but these...
I think about, you know, when the novel, it has so much to do with brothers and the father-son relationship. But to me, you know, the novel is, I think in some ways I wrote the novel because, you know, because I knew you and because I was such a mama's boy. And, like, I just could never conceive of men who had to become men without their mothers around, you know?
Yeah,
so for me, the heart of that story, that novel, is about, it's about a motherless boy.
Yeah.
And yeah, everything, you know, the mother's off screen because she dies in childbirth
in
the very first scene.
Yeah.
So all the action that takes place is about men and brothers and father-son relationships.
Yeah.
But to me, the real central conflict, I mean, Faulkner said, the best stories are about the human heart in conflict with itself. So that interior conflict that drives all of what happens in that novel is this: the fact that the boy misses
his mom,
has missed the opportunity to ever know his mother.
Yeah.
And he's trying to think about all these ways that he might have known her from in utero.
Right.
Like, he might have heard her voice, but he can't remember it, so he manufactures memories about it.
Right.
You know, that was the sort of... I'm always trying to write about something that I can't understand because I want to empathize. I think that's what artists do.
Yeah.
Is empathize with other people.
Yeah.
In really acute ways. So that's sort of that was the driving force there in the novel. It ends up being a pretty masculine, edgy work.
They are. Yeah.
But I think some of the most beautiful scenes, if there are beautiful scenes in the book, some of the scenes I'm most proud of in that novel are scenes about women.
Yeah.
You know. Midwife and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did you start writing that book in relation to, I mean, did you, I know that's a weird question. I don't quite know how to ask it because I've never asked somebody, so where'd you get the idea for the book? No, but you know what I mean? Were you working on outlines of it when you were in graduate school or was it just pretty much like hey, I've got to write this novel?
Yeah, I think I never really thought I was going to write novels. And then there's market pressure because short stories don't, you know, like, what are you going to do? I'm going to write short stories.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, what could you do to make less money than that? I'm going to write epic poems. All right.
Exactly.
what do you do to write less money than that? I'm just going to write these.
I'm going to become a mime.
That's right.
I can't think of anything. I'm going to be a magician, Mom. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, some of what drives fiction writers what drives fiction writers to write short stories to begin with is that's what you do in graduate school, because you can't take a novel into a workshop and say, here, everybody, read this 350-page manuscript by next Tuesday, and we're all going to talk about it. So you have to have something, you have to have a self encapsulated form that everybody can read and respond to.
Right.
And that's why there's so many short stories being written, which you think they'd work so well with the American attention span.
I know.
And they just have not come back for whatever reason.
I know.
And I think it's a vicious cycle because they don't market them very much. You know, the publishers aren't excited about having a book of stories come out for the most part. You know, they're excited about the novel, and they publish your short stories so that they can have your novel.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the way it works. So I was just writing short stories thinking I would be like Lee Abbott, who found a way, always taught, but never wrote a novel, always was a short story writer, was really committed to the form, did beautiful work, and was able to make a living just fine doing that. But eventually, I think what happens is if you're willing to start a project and you know that it's going to, like, you're not going to have any resolution. You're not going to know if you've succeeded at it or not for a matter of years rather than weeks. If you've got that sort of stubbornness or arrogance or whatever it is that compels us to do it, then eventually you've run across a story that's just a little big. You know, it's just a bigger story.
Yeah.
And you just keep going, which is what it's like. I can't remember who said it. There's this great metaphor. It was a woman. She wrote a book about the craft of fiction, and I can't remember her name. But she said, writing a novel is like driving across the country at night. You can only see as far as the headlights reach, but you can make the whole trip that way.
Yeah.
And that's very much like,
wow,
it's like
that's really,
you're in this, you know, for years, you know, you're in this situation where you're just sort of going forward and you don't know how it ends. I don't outline, you know, I think geniuses can do that and make art out of it. Like Faulkner, you go to Faulkner's house and there's... He outlined his stories, his novels, on the walls of his study.
Oh, really?
Like in pen, just right on the walls.
That's awesome.
And then he'd go, you know, when Faulkner finished a book, he'd just go on a bender.
Right.
And just go drinking for, you know, a couple of months. And then his hired guy would come in and paint the walls again. So he'd have a fresh
over.
Thing.
Right.
So, like, you can go and he's like, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it's still on the walls. And he's even got, like, little lines of dialogue. So he could see, he's a genius.
Right.
He could see all the way through to the end of a story. I can't do that. I don't know how it ends. I'm just following it.
When you're working like that, do you
drink a lot?
No. You live in your head, obviously, a lot. You'll be somewhere and someone will say something and you'll be like, you're not really, I could not take what they said, but it's whatever they're feeling in this. It reminds me of something that, you know, this person was saying in the book, and I can, you know, kind of transfer this sort of energy into that person.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because it's sort of, your focus kind of inverts itself from the interior to the exterior and then back the other direction. That doesn't make much sense. But like when you start working on a story, you're thinking, oh, well, this character's kind of like this guy I know, but he's also kind of like this woman I know, and they work in this place that's similar to something. So you're taking the external world and infusing the story with it.
Right.
But when you get a year or 2 years into a novel, that whole thing just sort of inverts, and you start seeing the exterior world in terms of your novel instead of the other way around.
Right.
So you're kind of living in it all the time. It's
right.
Like you sort of, it's like a good book. You
how
know?
How long did you spend working on it?
It's hard to say, you know, because that was a messed up time in my life.
Yeah,
I finished graduate school, and I was married, and we went to
you had a child. You got divorced.
Yeah, we were living in Boston because my first wife was in law school, and she was just about to finish law school, and we had my boy Dalton, and that was, I was finishing stories. I still had some stories that I wasn't satisfied with, and I was working on then. But that's when I started, like 2001. 2002, I just wrote the scene, and I didn't really know what it was doing and where it was going, but it didn't feel like a short story. And so I was writing, you know, scenes more than chapters for a couple of years. And then I got divorced, and it was kind of a messy divorce, and I had this tiny baby, and I didn't have a job. We'd moved back to Houston. I didn't have a good faculty job. I was living with my parents again after I split up. With my wife, and it was just this, it was dark, kind of a emasculating, you know, kind of depressed. I was waiting tables while I was teaching classes at the community college. I mean, it was broke.
Those are real times, though, that people go through.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
I mean, and there's people like us that revel, I mean, although we don't want to be in those positions and we feel they are emasculating and whatnot,
it was
still kind of revelant in the past. Like, oh, I had this experience, you know.
Well, it was a perfectly human experience, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, not that I, you know, I actually liked waiting tables. I just didn't like having to wait tables. You
I think
know?
You and me and my cousin Eric, who you're really close to as well, I think we all split up with our wives within weeks of each other.
Certainly months.
Yeah, I think it was weeks. Eric and I were like a week apart.
Yeah.
On that. Something was in the air.
So yeah, don't let us hang out together.
No.
We'll divorce you.
So you worked on it then for years.
Yeah, and then pretty much nothing but life was complicated, and I was so busy, and I was so worried about things all the time. So I would write every day while I was writing for, you know,
let me ask you this. What's your procedure? Are you like a wake up and I will write from 8 to 9 every day? Or,
no,
or,
I mean,
there's some guys that do that.
Yeah, some guys just are really.
I've done that before as a songwriter.
Really disciplined.
Yeah.
And I can be that way once I get to the end of something, but when I'm right in the middle and I think, God, this could, I don't know, have any idea how long I'm going to be doing this.
You might not finish.
It's real easy for me to go watch a football game and drink a beer instead of writing that day. It's really easy for me to do that.
I know those feelings.
But yeah, what I have to do, writing fiction like we were talking about before, where you sort of, when things are working creatively, it's kind of like dreaming while you're awake. You sort of lose yourself in the creation of the thing. So you're just kind of dreaming the story. So I like to start, like I get up early in the morning and don't do anything before I start writing. Like grab a cup of coffee.
Right.
I like white noise, so sometimes I'll go to a coffee shop. Yeah. I'll have a little bit of background noise. So, like, you know, get to a coffee shop when it opens at 5 or 5:30 and sit there for 2 or 3 hours. That's my favorite time to write because it feels like you're just going from one kind of dreaming to another.
Right.
And, oops. And, you know, the life hadn't gotten in the way yet. You know, it doesn't take long. You know, it doesn't.
That's true.
Not much time has to pass in the morning before, you know, the external stimuli start to affect you in weird ways.
Right. So The Wake of Forgiveness is out in paperback now.
Yeah.
And you can get it at your local bookstore, online, iTunes.
Just about everywhere. Books
Amazon.
Sold. Yeah.
They have an audiobook, which I'm pretty upset about. I don't like the guy's voice. I like your voice. I want all my writer friends to read their own shit, or at least give me a chance to read it.
Yeah, I'd like you to read it. I think that'd be good.
I've got the setup.
They didn't. That's right.
I mean, I could actually do my own audiobook
and
just send it to our friends.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was going.
Yeah,
somewhere
so I wrote.
That.
I mean, I wrote most of the novel second. I wrote most of these stories first, but it was just sort of a marketing Houghton Mifflin marketing decision to put the novel out.
And
first.
So you're gonna write another novel.
Yeah, I just started just started writing this.
Do you know, like, oh, well, this novel should be done by, do you ever say, do you? Do you
well, you tell you the publisher.
To, of course you do.
When you're going to deliver it, and then you don't. Right. That's how you do that. That's how everybody does it. No, I mean, technically, I think I really can. I don't
is it
think
their due
is,
date? Are they like, hey, Bruce, yeah, by, a, yeah, it's what, supposed April 2012 or something?
No, it's August 2013, I think. They gave me 2 years. So, and that seems that seems
a
like
part
enough.
Of me that if that was someone did that to me, it would be like July 15th, 2013, and I'd be like, "Fuck, I really got to start this book."
Yeah, when you're talking about, you know, 100,000 words, you can't really
Jesse
wait till the
would
last
be the
month.
Same way, wouldn't you? If they gave him his due date for his book is August 2013, but wouldn't you be like in like July 15th, 2013, like, "Fuck, I got to start this book."
Yeah, I can procrastinate, but not, I don't know. I think I can write this book in a year, year and a half.
Right, so you have years. No outline. You're just kind of writing.
No, I just have this situation. Just have this character.
Well, good.
And a title.
Well, can you share that, or you want to keep that? Go ahead.
Title is Until Daylight Delivers Me, and it's taken from this beautiful essay by a great writer named William Maxwell, who wrote this essay called Nearing 90, and he was talking about how now that he's 90 and he's an old man, he likes to remember.
Right.
Life almost as much as he liked living it, but he's got to be careful because it's like a mine shaft, and he'll start remembering things late at night, and he'll be just going lower and lower into this mine shaft of memories of his past, and he'll end up all night reliving moments from his life until daylight delivers him. And I just thought that's a freaking fantastic
great.
Line,
that's
and the story's very much
yeah,
it's told by
told
an
me
older
about that
narrator,
last night. Yeah,
and it's very much about memory and. Remembering and the frailty of memory, I think.
Dude, the title does have like a James Bond vibe to it, though.
Yeah, it does. It needs somebody to write a cool song.
I need to write a James Bond.
Need Sheena Easton.
Yeah, we need a good Sheena Easton. So while you're here, I would like you to read some.
Yeah.
I don't know what else we. I mean, is there anything else you want to talk about? What do you normally talk about in interviews? Have we talked about that stuff?
Yeah, we've talked about this. I mean. People, does this happen with songwriting? Like, when you're a writer, the reporters out there, they always want to find, like, what's the true story? Like, you write fiction,
yeah.
But what?
But who is this book really
what's
about?
The autobiographical
Well, you told me
part.
That this whole book's about me, the last novel. So.
Yeah, it's all about you. It's all about you.
So, yeah, let's get to the bottom
so
of this.
So this is, you know, there is no one character that's another human being, but surely... When you write fiction, you get in there. So I was thinking about all these industrial accidents when I was writing because I was going to all these plants.
Right, and they all seem, they
hang a, like out on the front marquee. There's 300 and something days without an LTA, which is a lost time accident. I was really interested in.
Cool, I read this last night in the tub.
I was really interested in those kinds of, like the pride and industrial accidents were just fascinating to me. When I was working... for the conveyor belting company, right before I went to graduate school, in Sugar Land, the big sugar plant in Sugar Land, Texas, was still a going concern. And this is just, it's just awful. But there was a guy who was cleaning one of the boxcars on break, and they'd shut the plant line down. And he fell asleep on his break inside one of these boxcars. And they didn't realize it till hours later, but they cranked the plant up again, and... Then just like, you know, just metric tons of raw sugar were getting thrown into all these boxcars. And so he suffocated down there. But what the writer in me thought, which I'm almost embarrassed to say, the writer in me thought he was suffocated by sweetness.
Yeah.
And there's something like just off-putting and fascinating and beautiful about that gritty, ugly truth. That's how I think. And so there were all of these... I'm going to read a little section from two different stories. But there's... I was interested in these specific machines. So this is... If I could find the right place. This is from a story called The Last One Left in Arkansas. I can see you. Okay. I'm just going to read the first page and a half of this. If it's too long, you can edit it.
No.
I'm no Arkansas native. Still, I've seen my share of strange skies. After Anne and I were married, we left Texas so that I could attend forestry school in Oregon. From the balcony of our apartment just south of Eugene, we'd watch the black Pacific clouds roll into the Willamette Valley, and even the birds would go quiet. It was a West Coast thing, like an earthquake, eerie, breathtaking, sometimes terrifying, but usually short-lived, over before the real panic had time to set in. When I was a kid in the Texas panhandle, clouds were recreation. God's truth, early one September, the entire third grade skipped the afternoon half of school to follow a low nimbus across the scrub grass field toward the creek bed. It was recess. Someone started walking, and we all followed, cooling ourselves under the only outdoor shade we'd seen in months. That was Texas. This is Arkansas. Here in this valley, clear through to March, when on nights like tonight I sometimes sit on the porch in my parka, sipping whiskey and shivering and trying to find just the right prayer for the son I lost 11 years back, or the courage to call the one who's alive but living hundreds of miles away, often even the clouds turn lethargic, and they sit, and they stay. They stay in such a way that tonight, if you sat in your truck at the intersection of the Mill Road and Highway 10, where the company land ends and the Ozark National Forest stands like a frozen wall to the north, your wipers would groan as they raked sleet from the glass. The clouds would hunker down, blocking out the moon, but even with one headlight out, you'd be sure to notice that they haven't replaced the sign on the corner yet. It still reads, 329 days without an LTA. Lost time accident. That's what they call it when someone saws through an arm or shears a hand in half with the planer.
Oh, no, but you did get to my favorite part, the part with the piggies.
Oh, okay, I'll keep going.
Keep going, please.
All it takes is a second of distraction, one turn of the head, one bad decision. When you spend a quarter of your life in the mill, you have to remember every second what the motors and blades are capable of. You don't wear loose-fitting clothes, and you don't take a drink at lunch. You don't work a station before you've been trained and certified. When you're on the line, you don't think about your wife's nice plump ass, and you don't worry about little Johnny's grades. You concentrate. I did it for 10 years before I made plant manager. Still do it when I'm out in the yard. There's rules and, as they say, you follow them so you can clock out and make your way home to play this little piggy with your babies without coming up short any piggies.
Such a great line.
Thanks, man. So that was my sort of fascination with, and there's this debarking drum that was this curious machine, and it's just this, I think the narrator of the story describes it as like a porcupine turned inside out. It's this huge metal pipe that turns, and it's got these spikes pointed inward, so you just shove these trees into the middle like huge logs.
Yeah, and it kind of crushes them.
And it turns, and it strips all those spikes strip all the bark off. And so I've imagined that was just the most ominous-looking machine I'd ever seen in all of my traveling around.
It's like an Iron Maiden, right?
Yeah. So I was thinking about that sugar accident, and then I'd heard this story about, and this is kind of how stories converge for me. All good stories are usually about two different stories are going on, and they resonate with each other. And then I'd read a paper. I'd been to Arkansas and camped up on this mountain, Magazine Mountain, and I'd read in the paper somewhere around then a story about two boys who had an accident on a dirt bike, and it was freezing at night, and they were off in the woods. But their dog was running along with them while they were running the dirt bike. I think in the real story there was only one boy, and the dog like kept the boy warm overnight and saved his life. Like slept on top of him to keep him warm. Like the dog just knew this kid's got to be warmer than he is. And those two things, for whatever reason, that industrial accident and then this, I just started imagining the father who works in this place where an accident has happened, and he's also the father of these boys, these young boys, in a family in which some you know, some traumatic event has happened.
Did you guys have any guys lose digits at the, and you guys cut the rubber at industrial rubber, didn't you? And you have like a,
yeah.
Like you come on big spools and you cut it in certain lengths and stuff. Did you ever have anyone lose any?
Yeah, I held two different times. I held a paper towel with ice and a thumb in it.
Where you came up with the story about the person driving around with the discarded, body parts.
Yeah, no, that story, I could read the beginning of that, just the first couple of paragraphs. That story, I worked as a courier, as a medical courier.
Oh, that's right. That's
when
right.
I was in graduate school at Ohio State to make some extra money.
Right.
And it was a great job because I'm a smoker.
Yeah.
And I could smoke in my car while I did this job.
Yeah.
So I was just driving around in my little Toyota all over rural, and it was all these outlying hospitals that didn't have their own pathology units.
Right.
And so they would get stool samples, blood samples, like biopsies, lumpectomies, breasts, and you would take them to the big city hospitals in Columbus at the Ohio State Medical Center. And then one day I got this call, I got a pager. This is the old days where you had a beeper,
right?
And a two-way radio in the car. And I got this, it just came across, it said, dedicated job, Washington Courthouse, Ohio, to downtown pathology. And I thought, this is awesome, because dedicated job means you drive there, you drive back, you don't stop anywhere else, and they paid really well. Those right. gigs paid good money. And I was on call, and I said, yeah, I'll take it. And then she said, okay. And she sent something else across, and it told me which hospital to go to in this little town, Washington Courthouse, Ohio. And then it just said fetal demise, which I knew the minute I had it that, you know, there's not going to be a way to not write this story, but it's going to take me a while before I can write the story. So I went to this hospital and picked up a styrofoam cooler with this little stillborn,
oh my God.
Kiddo in it. And I was just voyeuristic enough to where I didn't usually look at the manifest very careful, but I looked at the patients' names, and I turned the radio off so there wasn't any noise, and I didn't smoke.
You just took in the moment.
Because I wanted it to be it just felt like it was an important job. Somebody needed to take this, body back to the, to Columbus. And this, this little baby had parents out there in the world who loved him. So, I just felt like I'm not going to play rock music in the car while it's going to be quiet, and I'm going to keep the windows up and the air conditioning on and turn the two-way radio off until I get there and not smoke. And I was just, it felt like the right
Respectful.
Thing to do. Yeah. It felt like it was the right thing to do. So I had to write a story about that. Do you mind if I read just the first little bit?
No, please. I love that story. I remember when you first sent it to me, it was my favorite. It was one of those ones I was just like, fuck, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories that I've written. And it's called What You're Walking Around Without.
Right. Such a great title.
If in the last 10 years you've lived within 100 miles of Houston along the southwest corridor of Highway 59, and in that time you've had a breast removed, or both, or you've had a hysterectomy, or a lumpectomy, or a swollen purple mole dug from your skin, then this is true. Whatever your surgeon cut out of you spent some time with Dean Coven in his car. They put the breasts in quart-sized plastic containers with snap-on lids, the kind of cheap Tupperware Dean hopes they don't reuse. A uterus warrants a half-gallon bucket. Ovaries and tumors bob and float in pint-sized containers filled with gray liquid preservative. On a busy day, say a Friday like today, between his two insulated totes, Dean will have bits and pieces of 40 people sloshing around on the back seat by the time he makes it from Victoria to Deer Park, where he rolls slow into the neighborhood, pulling into the driveway of the house his injuries have purchased for him. And this is, this is the story where my experience on the oil rig and this experience as this medical courier sort of finally converged. Like, I found two stories that work together, which it's almost always how it works. Because this guy who's driving this courier route.
What's his name? Dean?
Dean Coven.
Dean Coven. Is that someone?
No, I mean, Coven I used as he was the owner of the conveyor belting shop. Right. So I do recycle names because I just like names.
Oh,
like
Coven.
Ike Coven. Ike Coven. And then his son Carl Coven. Yeah, so I use that last name. But yeah, this is the story in which, for me, imaginatively, like that experience offshore and this courier route, this transporting this little body kind of came together for me.
Wow.
And that's how it works.
Yeah.
For me.
Is there another story you want to read? Was there? You said there was another one that you wanted to read from.
Oh, there's a story I wrote about what happened in, well, there's my imagination of what it would have been like to live in Jasper right after the James Byrd hate crime.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
No, you said you wanted to read two, but then you just went on walking around without.
Yeah, I read two. I read the Arkansas story. Well, hey, man.
Hey, I'm not trying to make you do more than you need to do. I'm going to read some of the accolades you got for your last book, The Wake of Forgiveness. The New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, Mountains and Plains Booksellers Association Reading the West Award, Best Adult Title of 2010. You read adult books.
Yeah,
that's why I masturbated four times a year. But not the second time.
Yeah.
The Institute of Letters Debut Novel of the Year. The Texas Institute of Letters Debut Novel of the Year, sorry. Cleveland Plain Dealer, Best of 2010. ABA Indies Choice Debut of the Year Finalist. Barnes & Noble, Top 10 Fiction 2010. That's a big one.
Yeah, I mean,
because that's a bookstore that sells most of the books. Top 10 debut fiction from Amazon.com and one of the best novels by men in 2010 from the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I mean, the sort of critical success of the book was fantastic, and
and it sold.
Yeah, it sold well enough to where I get to keep writing books.
Yeah,
and people will actually print them as long as they're printing books. I don't know how much longer that's going
to
last.
Where else does this reading tour take you today? You're going to Dallas.
Yeah, I'm going to Dallas. I was in all the major Texas cities, Dallas being the last one, and then I'll go down and do a reading in the country in Hallettsville, where the first book was set. Right. They're really sweet to me down there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'll go back to New England. I'm teaching up in south of Boston now, living with my fiance and her couple of kids, and I'll read in Cambridge and Boston and a little town.
That was a long
Newton.
Time to get back up there.
Yeah,
and you just moved there a few months ago.
Yeah, that's right. It's tough. Four months ago. Move back. Takes a long time to get an academic job, there's just not that many of them out there, and there's hundreds of applicants for every one, so really I wasn't marketable at all before the first book came out.
Right.
And so now I get to teach creative writing and do creative writing and sort of live with my lady, which is just a great blessing. So I'll do three or four readings in New England.
Yeah.
And then I'll go in a week and a half from now, I'll go do some bookstores in the Rocky Mountains that were really good to the first book.
Right.
Store in Durango and the famous bookstore Tattered Cover in Denver. It's been there forever. And one in Edwards, Colorado, which I didn't know this, but I guess that's where Vail is. It's very close to Vail. So I'll do those readings and then we'll see what happens after that. But that's the official tour, Texas, the Rocky Mountains, and New England.
It's going to be a great time to be in Vail and in Colorado just before it gets too snowy.
Yeah, I hope it's not just dumping snow in November because I got to drive through all those mountains.
Ooh, yeah.
I'm not sure if I could drive in snow.
You
that's
can drive
for sure.
In snow.
But,
you live
but
in
the
snow.
Mountains, I don't know.
Is there anything else? What am I missing? I love you so much and I'm so proud of you.
Hey,
I
love you too.
I hate it when these interviews end like this. There's been a couple where I've just been like, I just love you so much, man. I'm just so fucking proud of you. And just what you, I really am though, man. Like, you really like, I know all of our friends are and it's amazing to see you get to do this.
Hey, well, I'm proud
it was great getting to go see you to be on that panel the other day with other real authors. You actually are a real author,
guys.
Not just my friend.
Well, I'm proud of you too, Johnny.
Well,
thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Right.
This is Bruce Mahart. Buy his book, Men in the Making, and buy his previous novel, The Wake of Forgiveness.
You want to do a giveaway, Johnny?
Oh, yes.
Let's do
That's
a giveaway.
Right. Let's
what do you want
a giveaway.
Them to do? They can... we'll do three books, three signed books, and I can inscribe them however you want, and you can... What do you want them to do?
Three different people. What should they do?
They should post something on your Facebook page for the yeah. for the show or something.
And you can't
like that.
Be friends with us. Like, you can't be like Craig writing in there, like,
yeah,
one of these guys trying to get a free book. What's a good thing of the short stories? I don't know. Write us and tell us why you think you deserve a book of short stories. And then, and we got to know you're going to read it too. It's just like, oh, hey, I won this. Because people that win things just win things.
Yeah.
My friend made a documentary about these people. It's called Contest Winners.
If you're calling
it's called
in,
Prize Horse, sorry.
If you're calling in to get a free book because you like have a bunch of parakeets
right.
or some shit like that, you could just fuck off.
You can win a copy of this novel by coming to our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? And like the page, first of all, and then write to us. So we'll be hearing from you next week. And then in some kind of private way, we'll get your address, and you will have won a book written by Bruce Mulhart, a book of short stories
That's right.
called Men in the Making.
The three best reasons why we get for why you deserve this book of stories.
Yeah, the three best reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll send, and I'll inscribe them and send them straight away.
And he will inscribe them, and he will mail. Oh, good. So that frees me from having to
You
go
don't have
mail
to do
place.
Anything.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I have to check my Facebook.
Well, that's right. You got to do that. But my dad was a mail carrier, so I like to go to the post
yes.
office. Fills me with
Papa Smurf. Let's give shout outs to Chris, your brother.
My brother, Chris Mulhart, the
yeah,
musician.
We
and,
actually
and the finest human being.
We
I
didn't
know.
Even talk about this, but we had my first band. Bruce was the drummer.
Yeah. Well, we'll do this when I interview you for my podcast.
Oh yeah. Oh great. More podcast people. No, I'm just joking. I look
so
forward to
I.
your podcast. I love you, Bruce. Congratulations. Everyone buy his book. Write to us on Facebook. You'll get a copy of his book of short stories, Men in the Making. It's at How Did I Get Here page on Facebook. I don't even know how to describe that. So thank you, Bruce. Thank you for coming. Thank you for reading. And thank you for staying on.
Thank you.
When you're the blame or making me blue.
All right, so that was my friend Bruce, lifelong friend since we were kids, still friends. And don't forget, you can go to my Facebook page, How Did I Get Here, on Facebook, and like it, and then write us as to why you think you deserve a book. Then we'll get your address, and hopefully you qualify, and you'll get a free book of short stories. It's really great. I've read it. It's amazing. Thank you so much for listening. My next interview will be with Kelly Willis, she'll be coming over soon to do that. So anyway, everyone, have a great day, and thank you for listening. Thanks to Bruce for coming by, and we'll talk to you soon.
I was so lonely, prayed for you only. Why should I keep loving you when I know that you're not true? And why should I call your name when you're the blame for making me blue?